Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. Here, we aim to provide you with the experience, strength, and hope of professionals actively working on the front lines in the field of food addiction. The purpose of our show is to educate you, the listener, and increase overall awareness about food addiction as a disease with abstinence as the solution. Here, we talk about all things recovery. Most importantly, how to thrive rather than just survive. So stay positive, make a change for yourself, tell others about your change, and hopefully the message will spread.
Continuous glucose monitor, what are they and are they helpful for the food addict? Welcome to the Food Junkies Podcast. My name is Dr. Vera Tarman. Today, we speak with Dr. Kolodzic, a medical doctor specializing in metabolic health and weight loss. Dr. Kolodzic completed his medical training at the Wright State University School of Medicine and has served as an assistant clinical director at this site since 1989. He is board certified in preventative and emergency medicine and has over 20 years of experience working in emergency medicine. He is also board certified in addiction medicine and has treated people with food addiction as well as weight loss and metabolic disease for the last 5 to 7 years. In addition to his practice, Dr. Kolodzic is the author of The Continuous Glucose Monitor Revolution, which provides a comprehensive guide on how to use these devices for improved health and weight management. His passion lies in educating people about the benefits of these devices to achieve weight loss using low-carb diets and other lifestyle changes. We at Food Junkies Podcast are wondering if these CGM devices can help us in food addiction recovery. So welcome, Dr. Kolodzic.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Now, please tell us how you discovered, first of all, the value of low-carb food plan. You're an emergency physician. And then how did you stumble upon the use of continuous glucose monitor devices?
Yeah, my background's in emergency medicine. I'm now almost 25 years in the emergency department. And what became evident to me over the course of that career is that the emergency departments are filled with preventable medical problems. And what gets all the press in the emergency department is the overdoses and multiple traumas and the gunshot wounds. But what emergency physicians see every day in, day out, all day long are vascular problems. And those vascular problems, I believe, are primarily the result of high blood sugar and obesity. So the kidney failure that diabetics have, the peripheral vascular disease, the heart attacks, the strokes, and it's not only mortality, it's morbidity, the peripheral neuropathy. And what became evident to me is that these problems are preventable. Unfortunately, we've been led down a path related to what has happened with the food pyramid and the healthcare system and the food processing industry, that if you want to counter that, you really have to think for yourself and you really have to educate yourself. So after seeing these problems in the emergency department for decades, I decided to get in front of that by opening my metabolic health practice now almost 7 years ago. And I treat patients for weight loss and improve metabolic health. And metabolic health is the opposite of metabolic syndrome, which I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with. And a primary tool to achieve improved metabolic health is a continuous glucose monitor.
How did you come across the continuous glucose monitor as a tool? Because it's not something that physicians use as a tool, usually.
Yeah, so these have been available for diabetics for about 15 years and used primarily to dose insulin, provide accurate measurements related to dosing insulin. But as I realized that the obesity and diabetic epidemics in the U.S. were primarily related to a high-carb diet, I began to look for a tool that would help people understand that. And so I began to wear CGMs myself and now have had hundreds of patients wear them. And it's interesting. You can sit down with somebody and you can say, you got to control your blood glucose. Or the typical thing in the States is the doctor sit down in their 20-minute visit and they basically say, eat less and move more. Eat less and move more. And of course, there's no motivation or really insight offered. But if you put a CGM on somebody and they see what's going on with their physiology, they see what's going on with their blood sugar, all of a sudden they understand. The last chapter in the book is CGMs Change Lives. And I use CGMs diagnostically for a couple of weeks where I just put them on people, say, don't change your diet. Let's just look and see where you live in terms of your blood sugar. And I really believe that CGMs change lives because as my patients have put it, once you see those graphs, you can't unsee them. Uh-huh. You understand what's going on and you naturally gravitate to a low carb lifestyle, and it really changes your thinking and your relationship with food.
Just because of that visual experience from Absolutely. Eating the food. And yeah, for our listeners who don't know, can you tell us what a continuous glucose monitor is and how it actually works?
Sure. So this is the device that you see on the back of diabetics and increasingly non-diabetics. And of course, I go ahead and provide them to non-diabetics and pre-diabetics in my practice. CGM is a device where a small electronic sensor is placed under the skin. It's applied by individuals at home on their own. It's a painless application. You then wear the device for a few weeks. The sensor picks up blood glucose reading in the adjacent capillaries just underneath the skin, just several millimeters under the skin in the subcutaneous tissue. And then it transposes that information to a phone app where you can see what your blood glucose is in real time, anytime, 24/7. And then you can sort through data related to what's going on with your blood glucose. What's the graph look like over the course of the last day? How do different foods you eat impact your blood glucose? What are your averages over a 24-hour period? How high are your spikes? What happens after you get a spike and you get that insulin release that often results in then a dramatic lowering of your blood glucose, the so-called sugar crash? So you have this just wealth of information that can be utilized to then, after a diagnostic phase, guide your diet going forward.
Is it as accurate as a blood sugar itself?
Yes. So if you look at the different mechanisms of determining blood sugar, if you get a blood draw, that is the most accurate. The CGMs are accurate generally within 5 to 7% of the actual blood sugar, but it's the same accuracy level as a finger stick. So diabetics Right. and other people that are sticking their fingers to see what their blood glucose is, the CGM provides the same level of accuracy.
Can you just, in a brief paragraph for a person who might be fairly new to this, just explain why we care about blood sugar? What is the connection between blood sugar, insulin resistance, and weight gain? Is it possible to do that in 30 seconds or less?
You might need to give me a little bit longer than that, but then I'll try.
Okay.
First of all, the reason blood sugar is a problem is because it's inflammatory. It attaches to everything. A hemoglobin A1C is simply the number of the glucose molecules that are attached to your hemoglobin in your red blood cells. Glucose molecules attached to our blood vessel linings causing inflammation. That's the reason diabetics have such vascular issues. Glucose attaches to our joints causing inflammation and pain. And I see dramatically with my patients when we lower their blood sugar, their joint pain goes away. But I'm going to give you my quick spiel on blood glucose physiology.
Yeah.
So ever since the diet changed back in the 70s, when the food pyramid was foisted upon us, and we went almost overnight from 50% fat in our diet to 50% carbs in our diet, and the inverse occurred related to fat, when we basically increased our carbohydrate intake, then blood sugars went up. And what happened is obesity followed, and then after that, the diabetic epidemic occurred. When you eat a carb, whether it's a complex carb or sugar, it doesn't matter. You think, oh, a potato is good. Rice has got to be good. But instantly becomes blood glucose in your system. Your blood glucose goes up. Insulin is released from the pancreas, and insulin is the signal to unlock the door for that blood glucose to go into your organs. And if you think about your organs, think about your muscles. So far, so good. Your muscles need energy to contract. But when your blood glucose is elevated for a longer period of time, because we're eating all these carbs, as opposed to our diet before the 1960s, when we're eating all these carbs, that extra blood glucose has to go somewhere, and it goes to the liver and it gets converted to fat. Some of it stays in the liver as fatty liver disease, but most of it gets deposited around the middle. What we do with a CGM is we lower those spikes, we lower those averages, and all of a sudden, instead of the organs having too much exposure to blood glucose, they're looking for another source of energy because there's not as much blood glucose around because you've altered your diet. And so what happens then? Those organs start looking down another source of energy, which is that visceral fat around the middle, and that fat gets broken down into fatty acids to serve as a source of energy, which then results in weight loss, lower blood sugar, improved metabolic health.
Good. Thank you. A person comes to see you and they've got prediabetes or some version of metabolic syndrome. And can you just walk us through the process of what tests you would prescribe? What are the standard tests And then what is it particularly outstanding about the continuous glucose monitor that makes you want to choose that one going forward?
Sure. So we use the CGMs in a diagnostic phase. So I put a CGM on patients for a couple of weeks. I say, don't change your diet. Let's see where you live, what's going on with your cores. And we draw a routine set of labs. And key in that routine set of labs is a fasting insulin level.
Yeah.
Because if you draw a simultaneous fasting insulin level and a simultaneous blood glucose, you can see the relationship between the two. If your insulin's up a little bit, then that means that your blood glucose should be down. But if your insulin's up and your blood glucose is not in a low range, that means your organs are resisting insulin. Basically, the signal from insulin. Basically, they're saying your muscles, your organs are saying, insulin, we've got all the blood glucose around here we need. We are not listening to you anymore. We are not taking in any more insulin. So you can calculate an exact level of insulin resistance based on those readings. So the diagnostic approach is a CGM for 2 weeks, a fasting insulin level. We do other labs. I do lipid labs. I'm not a non-believer in cholesterol, but for 90% of my patients, insulin resistance and high blood sugar is the issue far and away beyond what's going on with your cholesterol level. We have been sold a bill of goods related to what's going on with cholesterol, and it has to be micromanaged. For most people, even with high cholesterol, if they don't have the deleterious subunits, the bad subunits of cholesterol, it's not an issue. So we focus much more on what's going on with blood glucose and insulin physiology as opposed to cholesterol. So we gather this information over 2 weeks, and then we put a plan together to reverse insulin resistance.
Okay. And your book describes really nicely this idea about the fasting insulin versus the glucose and that concept.
Yes. Yeah. It's an important thing to understand, because once people understand this, then they get much more comfortable with a low-carb, high-fat diet, because low-carb diets are necessarily higher in fat. Obviously, we want to push the protein. And what I say with my patients is, let's target, you know, this number of grams of carbs a day. Let's target this amount of protein each day. And I tell them not to worry about the fat. Now, we do get into that over a period of time, when we talk about good fats and bad fats and avoiding inflammatory seed oils. But the focus really is on lowering carbs and getting adequate protein.
All right. So before we get into actually talking about diets, I would like to talk a little bit more about the continuous glucose monitor. So can you tell us a little bit about interpreting them? I'm wearing one right now. I've worn them in the past. Is if I eat something, how quickly will I see a response? If I don't see a response right away, does that mean that the food I'm eating is fine versus in an hour or 2 hours from now? How do we interpret data when we see it?
Yeah, the response is actually achieved within 5 to 10 minutes of the food you eat. So really what is happening is the sensors interacting with what's called the interstitial fluid, which is the fluid bathing the cells or in the subcutaneous tissue. Yeah. And then that fluid equilibrates with the blood glucose in the nearby capillary. So it does take 5 to 10 minutes to get an accurate reading.
Then, the food has to be digested, right? And then it has to be, doesn't that take time as well?
Yeah. The digestion can take a period of time as well. And of course, you probably talked about on your podcast the issue. In fact, you can get into a whole science here of high glycemic and low glycemic index foods and what order to eat your food in to mitigate a high blood glucose response. But yeah, there is a digestion period. But once that food is digested and that glucose is released into your bloodstream, the CGM will pick it up within 5 to 10 minutes.
So if a person is eating like a potato, they would expect to see some kind of a rise within 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah. Initially, it'll occur within 5 to 10 minutes. Again, the digestion period might take a little bit longer. Sugar is immediately absorbed readily, as opposed to a complex carb that needs to get broken down a little bit. So there is a digestion lag.
Okay.
But generally, most everybody sees a response, some type of response within a half hour.
Okay, that's fair. So if you have a meal and you want to see the effect of the meal, give it about 45 minutes and then you can see what the effect is. The other thing that you said, which I forgot about, was that if it goes up high, you also want to see if it crashes later, because that's a sign of a problem as well, because you don't want to be going up and down like that.
Yeah. So what happens is you absorb that glucose from sugar or a complex carbohydrate and you get a spike. And when you get it, once that spikes, insulin is released from the pancreas, and insulin often overshoots the mark. So rather than getting a slow, steady rise over a period of time, a lot of times then you'll get a crash where the blood glucose drops abruptly. And I have an experience with a number of my patients where once they eliminate those spikes and they even things out following the curves on their CGM, then it actually helps a number of problems. And I don't want to get too out there on this, but there's no question that when you avoid these spikes and drops, that fatigue levels are minimized. It can help with your energy levels. There's some evidence, in fact, there is a whole science being pursued now related to mental benefits of that. I think there's no question that if you have a crash of your blood sugar, it can just impact a little bit of mental fatigue, maybe mental clarity. And there's some work going on, and I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Chris Palmer, who's a Harvard psychologist.
Yeah, for sure.
Who recently wrote a book called Brain Energy, where he believes this blood glucose variant can impact all types of mental disease, including have an impact on depression, anxiety, maybe even bipolar disorder.
Yes. Patterns to look for. Can you talk about the key patterns that you would be looking for?
Yeah. So what I do with my patients is once we identify during that trial phase, their spikes, but basically we look at how high do their spikes go. And I have patients come in that phrases, I just want to lose 20 pounds. I just want to lose 30 pounds.
Yeah.
And they don't really have an emphasis or a focus on metabolic health. And you put a CGM on and they're spiking their sugars to 190, sometimes 220, 240. So they're really in a pre-diabetic situation that they didn't know about, because our whole different discussion, but our medical care system really isn't good at dealing with that. Just as an aside, if you have prediabetes, lights and sirens should be going off, because you want to reverse that prediabetes before it progresses to diabetes. If your doctor's saying your blood sugar is a little bit higher, we need to check your blood sugar again in a few months, that's code for you're either prediabetic or almost prediabetic.
Yeah.
So we follow these spikes and then we follow the averages and then we set goals. We want to keep your spikes below 140, for example. The party line in medicine is once your blood sugar is over 140, you may be getting some vascular inflammation. So we often hang our hat on keeping your spikes under 140. And then it's variable from person to person, but we set the average for an average over a 24-hour period for a certain goal as well. Some people can get under 100. Some people can even get in the low 90s. Sometimes people that have significant insulin resistance, it's hard for them to do that initially. So we go ahead and we set these different goals, and I work with patients to meet those targets with dietary education. And then there's a couple other things we do, which we should get into, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, because there are two other ways to lower insulin resistance, and that is intermittent fasting and strength training.
I want to back up for the Canadian listeners who don't use those same numbers. I think 90 is equivalent to, is it 5.7? Do you know the Canadian version?
Oh man, I'm sorry. I do not know those as well as I should.
And you said 140 is pre-diabetic?
So in the U.S., anything over 100 fasting blood sugar is considered pre-diabetic.
That is fascinating.
What I'm saying is at a level of 140, you really don't ever want your blood sugar above 140, because at 140, that is the point at which there is some vascular inflammation taking place.
So the difference between fasting blood sugar and eating, that can be quite a range. But we want the range then to be in the low 90s, preferably 90, up to what? Up to 120? That is a safe range?
Yeah, really, you're okay up into the 130s or so.
Really?
Yeah. You don't want it there constantly, but I'm saying after a meal, if you get a spike into the 130 range, that is not a terrible thing. And you got to understand, a lot of my patients come in, so I adjust their goals individually, but I have patients that come in and they're spiking to 240. They're actually in a diabetic range and they don't know it. So the aggressiveness with which you set the targets is dependent on the individual, because you don't want to defeat somebody either. You don't want to set a target for them that's not achievable. Let me mention, if I can, the other components of the program. So in addition to a low-carb diet, and another great way to lower insulin resistance is intermittent fasting.
Okay.
And I'm sure you've talked about that. I push my patients really for, they've never done any fasting before. I'm not talking about a three-day fast. I'm talking about, look, let's get to 12 or 14 or 16 hours of fasting on a routine. routine basis. And if you're having a family event, you're going out to dinner with a spouse or there's a birthday, then that's okay. You can go ahead and there can be some flexibility there. But intermittent fasting is a big component. And then, oh, you got a friend there, I see. Yeah. And then the other component, which I really emphasize with my patients, which is important for people to understand, is strength training. So the physiology here is if you can increase your muscle mass, you can increase the quality and the receptivity of the insulin receptors on your muscles. They're going to soak up more insulin, and then they're going to soak up more blood glucose. So that is going to help reverse your insulin resistance. I emphasize strength training for my patients much more than cardiovascular. It's not that I don't believe in cardiovascular training. It's you can do what the American Heart Association recommends, which if you do a rigorous cardiovascular workout, you can get all that done in 75 minutes a week, three 25-minute sessions, a couple 40-minute sessions. And then let's focus on strength training, because strength training is going to help you reverse insulin resistance. It's a huge issue as we all get older in terms of having adequate muscle mass, because we're losing muscle mass, 7% of our muscle mass every decade.
Right.
Once we're over 35, it's a huge issue for women because of the risk of osteoporosis. And the more muscle mass you have, the less osteoporosis you're going to have. So I put a huge emphasis on strength training for my patients. So
especially for people on Ozempic or something where they're losing that muscle.
You should not be on the GLP-1 medicines without doing strength training. That it's a huge mistake for that, because you're losing weight and you're feeling good about that, but you are losing muscle mass too. Anybody that is on those medications should be doing strength training and should be getting adequate protein.
Yeah. Okay. So this is part of your three-prong approach then.
Yeah. Yeah. And since you mentioned the medicines, I do layer that into a limited extent for patients that get in a stall. But there's a mania out there related to these medications right now. And it's crazy. You can go on the internet and do a 15-minute appointment and be sent medicine for the next 6 months. No requirement to be on any kind of special diet or strength training program or anything. My philosophy, since the genie is out of the bottle on these medications and people are going to use them, so the way I use them is in very limited amounts with a goal set for how many months, not years, how many months you're going to be on the medication. You don't want to start a medication and then be dependent on it for the rest of your life. And the only way you inhibit that dependency is to do all the things we've been talking about up to now.
Yes.
Low carb, strength training, intermittent fasting, and preferably low carb on a continuous glucose monitor.
Now, I want to back up again, because I got my numbers. In terms of Canadian versions for people who are listening, basically, you want to be between 5 and 6.5. And as a physician, 7.3 is where we mark the beginning of prediabetes. 6.5 is equivalent to about 120. And you're saying 120 is okay? Maybe 130 once in a while, but you want to be between 90 and 120, more or less.
And that's a post-meal spike. And that might even be the special occasion post-meal spike when you go out on the weekend. You got to set a ceiling. But I'll tell you, it's variable dependent upon the individual. If I have somebody come into my office and they're spiking to 220 and I say, you have to be under 130 now, they're going to have trouble getting there because they have insulin resistance going on already.
Right.
So I use an incremental approach. We basically set a target, we meet that target, and then we set a more rigorous target.
When somebody says, I'm more carb sensitive, that is really a way of saying that they are probably pre-diabetic. Carbohydrates more reactively than somebody else.
The issue is insulin resistance. So what it really means is they probably have some insulin resistance brewing. And we use these arbitrary cutoffs. I think the 100 cutoff for pre-diabetes is somewhat arbitrary, because generally it's believed that if you're in the mid-90s to high-90s, then you've got insulin resistance brewing maybe for 4, 5, 6 years or more before you even get diagnosed as pre-diabetes.
When you're in your mid-90s, you're already
Yes.
So for Canadians, that's a blood sugar of 5. And I, for example, my average blood sugar is 5.3. So you're telling me that is already an insulin resistant potential range.
Yeah, just the distinction of terms. You mentioned pre-diabetic. I can't say people are pre-diabetic if they're in the 90s, because the criteria in the States is 100.
No,
but I will say that they've had insulin resistance for some time.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's very interesting. So that I or others should aim to have their blood sugars in the 80s.
If you can get there, again, I don't want to discourage people that have difficulty getting there. The natural history of blood sugars, even older people, if you age long enough, you're going to get some insulin resistance and be diabetic. That's why we see even slender people in their 80s or so that are diabetic, and you wouldn't expect that. There's a natural history there of progression. Okay. So I think
just diet then.
No, there's an aging factor, but you got to take that into account as you put your battle plan together to prevent ever progressing to diabetes. And again, is an urgent situation. Unfortunately, we don't treat it that way. The party line in general, though there's some controversy about this, the party line in general is prediabetes is reversible completely, so you never progress to diabetes, though different physicians are using different terminology. Some physicians are saying diabetes is reversible. I'm actually not so bold as to say that. I usually say diabetes can be put in remission, which means basically you can get patients off medication. And I've gotten lots of patients off even insulin. In fact, one of the things that kind of sent me in this direction, I got to tell you this anecdote, is I was working in the emergency department one day, and I went to see a patient, and we have computerized medical records so I could see what's going on with them before. And they were just there for a fractured wrist or something like that. And I was just going over with their history, and I said, I see you're diabetic. And I'll never forget, this gentleman said to me, he goes, I used to be. I said, what are you saying? You used to be diabetic. I educated myself and I reversed that, and I'm low carb now, and I've done these other things, intermittent fasting and strength training, and I've reversed my diabetes. And sure enough, I went and looked at his A1C, and previously it was like 9.5, and now he was down at 5.4. Sometimes we learn more from our patients than we give them. And that gentleman sent me down this rabbit hole of low carb improved metabolic health. And it was a very important moment. It's probably our healthcare system. I don't think in either country deals with insulin resistance aggressively. And again, I'm not intimately familiar with the way healthcare is provided in Canada, but in the US, what has happened now is that we've become a disease management healthcare system, where you go in and you see your doctor for 30 minutes every 6 months or a year. And if you've got medical problems, there's hardly any more time than to say, we're going to adjust your blood pressure medicine. We're going to adjust your diabetes medicine. We're going to adjust your cholesterol medicine, and I'll see you in 6 months. So my practice really was an independent practice. And I actually have physicians that refer patients to me from their practice because they would like to do more for their patients. They understand the importance of these metabolic health approaches with diet and exercise and intermittent fasting, but the system is not set up to allow them really to intervene and do much more than disease management. So basically, my work complements what they're doing related to disease management. But one of my favorite things to do is get a patient to the point where they can have medicine de-prescribed.
Yes.
Okay. So in other words, they're on metformin. They no longer need metformin. They're on amlodipine for their hypertension. They no longer need it because I've helped them lose weight and reverse their insulin resistance. People have the power. They don't realize the power that you have individually to control your health futures. We've been lulled into this sense of dependency related to, if I have a medical problem, I'm just going to, there's just going to be medicines to treat it.
Yeah.
And there's an approach here between an issue swimming upstream to educate yourself. That's why I'm glad people were listening to your podcast and doing that, because everything is pushing us in the other direction. The food processing industry, where 70% of the food we eat is processed, the pharmaceutical industry that shows us on TV commercials that there's a pill for everything. I remember the days when there weren't any drug commercials on TV.
Yeah.
But now you've got this ailment or that problem. It's take this pill or take this shot. And then unfortunately, the medical system, I mourn the loss of what I saw when I first got out of my residency, because docs were in their own offices, kind of small business people that had these special relationships with their patients. And now we call them clients or consumers or something like that. But something was lost when the docs allowed themselves to be purchased by health systems and sometimes private equity groups, and they're relegated to this 20-minute appointment where they can't do as much for their patients as they want to do.
Good.
Hey, Food Junkies listeners. We're just going to take a quick break here to share with you something our team thinks could help benefit your recovery with food, body, or self. Thank you again for listening.
Bethany here. Have you ever heard of the Enneagram? Have you ever wondered what it is and how it can help you in your recovery? Have you been a bit curious or even confused about what number you are? I like to think of the Enneagram as the owner's manual you wish you were born with in order to understand your own operating system. We already know that the journey of recovery is about knowing yourself, knowing your patterns, your behaviors, making changes to get unstuck, and then breaking free from habits and patterns that aren't serving us. And the Enneagram gives you a roadmap for this very process. This is why I'm super excited to bring you a new Sweet Sobriety workshop about the Enneagram. In this workshop, you'll have the opportunity to learn about the Enneagram and how it can help you in your recovery and discover your own Enneagram number. Over 4 video sessions, we're going to cover what the Enneagram is and how you can use it to accelerate your recovery, the 3 centers of intelligence, the gut, head, and the heart, and which ones are dominant and repressed for each of us, our basic core desires and core motivations. These are the things that propel us into behaviors that might sometimes be mystifying to us, our core fears, and the childhood messages that we received and the ones that got lost. There will be homework assignments and downloads included, as well as a resource list to continue on your Enneagram journey. This will be a very personalized journey, and we will have a chance to discuss what you're learning in 4 live group coaching sessions so that you can level up your recovery and be more at ease with yourself and the world around you. The workshop will run in May of 2024 with live sessions at noon on Wednesdays, May 1st, 8th, 15th, and 23rd. And if you're listening to this beyond the spring of 2024, it's not too late. You can still access the home study for this course on the Sweet Sobriety website. So the cost is $50 US. You can visit sweetsobriety.ca to register. The Enneagram can act as a map to our inner work. I would love to support you in looking at your map and determining how to use it to get to where you want to go. Hope to see you there.
Now back to the show. If you have enjoyed this episode, please let us know. We love to hear from you. Kindly leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to our podcast on. We love getting feedback from our listeners.
So before we get to diet changes, there's also the circadian rhythm where there seems to be a spike in the morning. Is that the case for everybody? And why does that happen?
Yeah, it's variable. Okay. Some people have a dawn DAWN effect and other individuals don't. But what happens is your body gets into a circadian rhythm when it knows when you're about to get ready, get up in the morning and get ready for your day. And so your body will release some cortisol and release some adrenaline, epinephrine, basically. And that will boost your blood sugar a little bit in the morning. Usually it's not dramatic, but you will see a rise. And I do have patients with CGMs on. They come in to me and they say, hey, I wasn't even up yet. I didn't even eat anything. And my blood sugar bumped into the high 90s after being in the 70s overnight. What's going on? And it's just a natural thing associated with that circadian rhythm and a release of cortisol and adrenaline. And I'll mention the same thing happens to people when they exercise. It's almost like a fight or flight phenomenon. You get release of cortisol and adrenaline and you will see your blood sugar bump. That's basically just a release of the stored glucose you have in your body in both your muscles and your liver called glycogen, which is just complex glucose molecules.
Okay.
So that is not anything to worry about.
Okay, so that's a natural variation that might happen along with aging. So now let's talk about the things that can really change, and that would be the food that we eat. I know you mentioned low carb, but there's many versions of low carb.
Yeah, so I go through all these in the book, all these different diets. This is my belief, that people will gravitate toward the diet that fits them best. Different versions of low carb. You can do a low carb Mediterranean diet if you avoid the bread and the pasta. Obviously, a paleo diet. You can be aggressive and do a keto diet. Some people are on a carnivore approach these days, where you eat nothing but meat. But my goal with my patients really is to collaborate with them on setting a carbs per day target. Basically, we want to generally go under 50 grams of carbs a day. And then I ask them really what they want to gravitate to. I don't want to be too hands-on. I don't want to micromanage their diet. I don't want to tell them they have to do this meal plan or that meal plan. So I actually think diets inherently are a bit restrictive. So I want to give them the freedom to go ahead and pursue the approach they need. We talk about the foods you eat and what order you should eat them in. Obviously, you should always try and have your carbs later in the meal, getting your fat, your protein in. Adequate fat is important. People don't understand this because we've been led away from fat so much, but fat is satiating. Fat narrows the valve between the stomach and the intestines called the pyloric valve. Your stomach stays fuller longer. I think an adequate amount of fat is, of course, very important. I don't micromanage my patients' diets, but I do insist on, let's keep your carbs under this. Usually protein needs to be, depending upon the size of the person, at least 100 grams, unless you got kidney disease, 100 grams, 120, 140 grams. Again, what distinguishes me in my approach with my patients is that I tell them not to worry about fat too much, and I tell them not to worry about their cardiovascular training too much, which is, of course, just the opposite of what they hear from their doctor when they go to see their doctor.
Yeah. Now, can't too much protein also cause an insulin spike?
Yes, it can. So you got to keep an eye on that as well. You got to be careful with that. But
you can't just do a big steak, like a huge 32 ounce.
You can't. Steaks have fat in them, and fat is satiating. You think about it. You can eat a bag of chips or a couple bags of chips, but you can only eat so much steak or so much butter. The problem in the U.S. is, and I think in Canada, is that we don't get adequate amount of protein. And if you're strength training, you've got to get that protein. And so I rarely run into a patient that has issues with too much protein, because people in general should be shooting for that 100, 120, 140 grams a day. And I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but the standard American diet, people are probably getting 50-ish or less grams of protein a day.
Was there anything more you wanted to say about the GLP-1s? Because you did say in your book, you will tolerate a person using them in the context of your other plan, especially strength training, as you said. Did you want to say anything more about that?
No, just that my goal as a practice is to capture people that might otherwise just be using the medicine and not do anything else. So rather than have those people go do that, I'd like to bring them into an environment where they understand the importance of the other things that we do, the diet, the strength training, and the intermittent fasting. But again, my goal is to begin with the end in mind. And the end in mind is that you're going to be off these medicines in a matter of months. They have to be titrated up, moderate doses, and then titrated back down. So I don't use high doses. I use low to moderate doses. I never get to the higher range of these medications. And then we titrate people back down because they put the lifestyle tools in place to maintain that weight loss.
They do maintain the weight loss.
Yeah, absolutely. We do lifestyle changes with patients and they understand. And again, for 5 years before the meds were prominent, that's all we did. And I had people have great success. People sometimes get stalled, and so we'll dip our toe in the water of these medications and get them through that. But it's always with the idea that we want to use them for a limited period of time. These medicines really have only been widespread use, even when they were just used for diabetics, for a limited period of time. There are side effects to the medicines. There are complications to the medication. So I just think it's prudent to use them in limited amounts or limited periods of time. And if people are doing the things that they should be doing that we've talked about here, they really are going to do just fine. They don't need higher doses. And I do not want patients to come to me and for me to start them on a medicine and basically say, you're going to be dependent upon this for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Okay. And that is going on out there. And people need to go into this process with their eyes open.
Yeah, I belong to a couple of doctors' Facebook groups, and the doctors themselves are talking about taking it themselves. And they're like, no problem, I'm a lifer. Like, they're not even questioning this.
Yeah, I disagree with that. The pharmaceutical industry would like you to buy into the fact that this is a disease process and just your high blood pressure, it may require management for the rest of your life. And I just don't buy that. I don't believe in that approach. I'll be honest with you. I just don't want to practice that way.
Yeah,
I want to serve patients and have them have good outcomes. And I don't think it's necessary. You know, for the vast majority of people, I don't think lifetime use is necessary. I think you can meet your goals without it.
Now, back to the CMD, what are some limitations? Where would you be hesitant to use it?
I have a chapter in the book on this, on what are the downsides of using a CGM? Could it make people over obsessive, for example, about the food that they're eating? And I'll be honest with you, I have not seen that. I think instead what happens is people go through a learning curve, and I'll use it in the diagnostic phase, and then we'll use it in the therapeutic phase for several months. And then they get it and they know where they are, and they will then go back to using one intermittently, but they don't need it all the time. In terms of complications, bleeding, infection of the devices, I really don't see a lot of downsides. I guess one is an expense for most patients that I have insurance. It's interesting, even though they are diabetic in the States, if they have private insurance, usually they get the cost of these cut in half. So it usually costs them about $35 for a 2-week monitor. So the expense can be a downside, but quite honestly, I don't think there is a lot of downside to using these devices.
Okay. Any limitations? Or
no, once in a while you get a bad monitor.
Oh, all right.
It's not really a bad monitor. Is what happens is sometimes when you start monitor, you'll get a low reading for the first day or so until that sensor settles into that interstitial environment. And maybe 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 12 times the monitors are used, I continue to get some falsely low readings. And so that can be a downside that you have to swap it out. I have found I use primarily Freestyle Abbott's, and the company has been very helpful. If a patient's having an inaccurate reading, they just call Abbott, the maker, and they usually get overnighted a new one. So it's a little bit of a hassle. I have not had any patients that have had symptomatic hypoglycemic episodes. So even when these monitors might be a little bit inaccurate, I don't have patients really that are having any medical problems or lightheadedness or dizziness from low blood sugars. I just have not seen that clinically.
You have been working in metabolic disease, but you also have now training in addiction medicine. Yes. And on your website, I think you say that you've treated food addicts. So are we different? And how have you found the continuous glucose monitor useful in this context, food addiction?
Yeah, I think it's the same thing. People see data for the first time and they begin to understand. It can be light enlightening. So it helps with that understanding, and then it helps with guidance of that food dependency. And for those, I don't necessarily tout this a lot. I can look at all that data remotely. So for some patients, that accountability is helpful for them. I will tell you the times that I have to intervene, I can count on one hand over the last 7 years, because if people have high numbers, they self-correct. It might take a few days, but they self-correct. So again, I think these are great tools in terms of limiting carb intake and helping modify habits going forward. So again, I don't see a downside with the devices, and I think they're very helpful in terms of education.
Do you think that they are helpful in terms of determining what might be a triggering food or not, or does it not really translate in that way?
Helpful in terms of a triggering food in terms of what might lead then to...
Or just if I eat something and I see a rise, that maybe that's what I should avoid because I have a high sugar and therefore higher craving or something like that.
No, yeah, definitely. People learn over a period of time to associate with, they understand what foods they eat are going to end up in a spike. Since we're talking about food addiction, I'm going to go somewhere else, and I'm going to bring this up because of my background in addiction medicine, which are where I've worked with a number of alcohol patients, some food addicts, but I'm going to mention the medicines again, the semaglutide, what's going on in that arena with alcohol. Have you had any discussion of this on your podcast at all?
I'm aware that the idea of using these for addiction alone is in discussion. Do you think we should?
I think it's interesting. So I've worked with a lot of patients dependent upon alcohol over the years.
Yeah.
And our armamentarium related to medications for alcohol use disorder is limited. I find that naltrexone is probably the best medication to use. It can be given as a shot called Vivitrol. I actually think it's more effective. In case your readers want to look this up, naltrexone used with a method called the Sinclair method. The Sinclair method is when you take naltrexone on days you drink alcohol. Naltrexone is an opiate blocker, so it blocks the natural opiates in the brain. And so you then can mitigate the feeling you get from alcohol. alcohol by taking naltrexone on days you drink alcohol, and then you try and let those receptors run wild doing something enjoyable on days you don't drink. But what has been unmistakable to me is the response that people get from the use of semaglutide, you know, Ozempic will go to alcohol. There's no question in my mind, and I don't know if it's just primarily the fact that your hunger center, your hypothalamus is being affected, and the response to alcohol is being mitigated. But I have lots of patients that drank alcohol moderately before they started the medicine and decreased their alcohol consumption considerably. Now, I don't know if that's just because their hunger center is being suppressed or whatever. I'm going to make a prediction, though. I do think these medications are going to find their place into acceptance for the use of addiction disorders. And I'm actually just very interested because of the problems that I've seen with alcohol in the emergency department and in my private practice, that this medication might be helpful. Now, right now, you can't do that. It's not FDA approved for that use, though I will tell you, I have had patients that are both overweight and drink more alcohol than they want, and this has helped them limit their alcohol use. So this is interesting. This is not mainstream medicine at all. Okay. So I want people to understand, but I do think that long term, once the studies get done, this may be a tool to be used for alcohol use disorder.
But hopefully in the same way as we're talking with obesity and diabetes, a temporary tool, not an ongoing forever tool.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Basically, it's an opportunity to realign your habits and lead a healthier lifestyle.
These devices, what do you see as the future? They're relatively expensive. I'm anticipating that they'll get cheaper and more prevalent, but what's your thought? And would you like to see that happen?
Yeah, they will over time. And I don't know what the situation is in Canada, but in the US, actually, Dexcom, one of the manufacturers, is seeking FDA approval to make these available over the counter. So right now in the US, you need a doctor's prescription for them. But long term, I think they're going to be available over the counter. They are in Europe and in Canada. Are they available over the counter?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes, they are. They're more expensive. But yes, you can go to the pharmacist and ask and buy them over the counter.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's the issue, the expense. But again, people can use them diagnostically first for a few weeks, hopefully in association with a provider that can provide them some guidance. And then I have some patients, it is interesting. I have some patients that put a CGM on and they never want to be without a CGM for the rest of their life. They depend on it constantly. And it's like they gamify their diet. They look at making sure they keep their numbers under a certain level. But I do have other patients that after wearing one for a few months, feel that they understand, and then they'll go back to using one intermittently. And of course, that will mitigate the expense. But there's no question in my mind that they should not be reserved for just diabetics that are dosing insulin, because it's really such a useful tool, I would say essential tool in helping people improve metabolic health.
Do you think that they are as effective for people who are vegetarian or vegan and are by the nature of their diet, having to eat more carbohydrates, are they as effective for that crowd?
Yeah, it's tough. That's a tough crowd to go, and you've probably talked about it, to go aggressively low carb. It can be done. And I've had a few vegetarian patients, no vegan patients, but vegetarian patients, and they have been able to use the CGMs effectively, but it is a challenge to be on an aggressive low carb diet, 50 grams or less, and be a vegetarian. The answer is they can be helpful, but overall, that's a bit of a challenge.
If the continuous glucose monitors become more prevalent, it is in a way a way to let low carb food plans become more prevalent, because right now they're still considered a little bit off. It's only if a handful of doctors that are promoting it. Most of them are still in the standard American diet or Mediterranean diet or vegetarian diet. If we see more of these devices, it is really promoting low carb, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It is. CGMs really aid low carb diets. We haven't focused on this enough. And the amount of nutrition education you get in medical school is still very limited. And quite honestly, a lot of it's based still back on the food pyramid. Even diabetics are really, I don't think, educated well related to lower their carb diets. I have some friends that are diet dietitians, and if they're low carb, they call themselves, what's the term they use? Born again dietitian, because they finally got it, because the nutritional world still isn't embracing this. And I think the data is undeniable. You look at the food pyramid came out in 72, obesity in the next 10 years, diabetes 10 years after that, vascular disease after that. Look at movies and photographs from the 40s and 50s. We didn't have the degree of obesity back then that we do now. So when you're advocating low carb, really all you're advocating is going back to the way we have traditionally eaten before the food pyramid was introduced and the food processing industry basically began to direct the way we were going to eat.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be nice if an intern, along with getting their stethoscope, would also get a seat as well in their little package from the drug company?
Yeah. Medicine changes so slowly.
Yeah. What is next for you? You've got this great book, and people, please, if you're thinking about using one of these devices, it's definitely a companion book to help you understand what you're looking at, along with getting help from a provider. But what's next for you?
Yeah. So my passion right now is just growing my practice and see if I can help more people. So I am licensed. My practice name is metabolic.com. So it's the word metabolicmds.com. I'm licensed in Ohio, Indiana, Florida, and Arizona. I'm growing the practice, and the growth so far is really exponential. And I think this is really picking up now as people become more aware of metabolic health and low carb is more accepted. Low carb has been around for 50 years. It no longer can be considered a bad diet. So if people are interested in my practice, I'm licensed in those four states. And then I just love talking about CGMs. The name of the book is The Continuous Glucose Monitor Revolution. It's available on Amazon and Audible as well. So if your readers are looking for it, that's where they can find it.
That's great. And I would highly recommend that you read it. Okay, so signature question. If you could tell a younger version of yourself something about this device or about insulin resistance, what would it be?
My advice would be try a CGM. Yeah, because again, last chapter in the book is CGMs change lives. And I've had those younger patients in my practice. And when you see a 19-year-old whose family is diabetic and obese, and the direction of their health future changes on a dime, because the young people are very data-driven, they understand this. It's very satisfying. So what I would say is educate yourself, try a CGM, educate yourself about low carb and about metabolic health. Understand that there are other important components of this, like we've talked about here, intermittent fasting and strength training. And just don't buy hook, line, and sinker. Really, what we have been told by the government, for lack of a better word, because of the food pyramid that's put out by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, what the food processing industry is telling us, and then also understand that there are alternative approaches to medical delivery from the standard approach that's often taken, and you have the power, you have control over your health future. You just need to go ahead and grab it.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time in talking about the continuous glucose monitor.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on Food Junkies, Recovery from Food Addiction. Make sure to join our Facebook group, Sugar Free for Life support group, I'm Sweet Enough. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or Stitchers. That way you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. Don't forget to pick up your copy of Dr. Tarman's book, Food Junkies, which is available on Amazon. If you have any additional questions, both Molly and Clarissa are food addiction professionals and work one-on-one with clients. You can find their websites and email addresses in the show notes. Be sure to tune in every Friday when our new episodes drop. As Vera loves to say, the power is ours.